Revelation chapter 1, John begins in verse 9 by saying, I, John, your brother and companion, was on the island of Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. John being on an island of Patmos, we don't know exactly when this was. Last week, I kind of set it up. I personally believe it was in the late 60s AD, which means that John at this time is probably about my age, maybe a little bit older than me. A lot of people say, well, he wasn't very old. Yes, he was. You need to understand that in that time, the average age, for people to live would be about the mid-40s, maybe 45, 46 years old. They didn't have modern medicine like we have today. And I think back to the fact that 10 years ago, I went through triple bypass surgery. I had what was known as the widowmaker that was becoming blocked. And I'm pretty sure that if I had not had surgery, I probably wouldn't be here today. And so for someone to live in their 60s back then was pretty astonishing. Some people date it to the 90s, which would have put John at about 90 years old. And so whether he was 60 or 90, he was on up in age. And he was on the island of Patmos. The island of Patmos is located just off the coast of what is today modern day Turkey. He had been working in Ephesus before being exiled there. I personally believe that the war between the Jews and the Romans were going on, and that he was exiled as part of that war movement by the Romans. But imagine, if you would, just for a moment, what it must have felt like when the boat carrying John pulled up to the shore. Here's a man either in his 60s or in his 90s, and you're being exiled. Perhaps he's got a bag carrying what little bit that he owned. Perhaps he didn't. You're going to an island that's sparsely populated. You're being basically rejected by the Roman Empire and being told, we're going to put you somewhere where you can no longer disturb the peace. And I've oftentimes wondered what it was like for John as he's there on that island and he's watching the boat go away, knowing that now he's all by himself, perhaps for the first time in his life. I mean, he had grown up on the Sea of Galilee. He was a fisherman. His brother had fished with him. His friends had been people like Peter and Andrew. I mean, he had been called into service with Jesus. He was a part of the church in Jerusalem. And then war breaks out and he goes to Ephesus. Why? Because now so many of them that he had known has passed away. His brother James had been beheaded. Peter had very likely been crucified. Paul had been beheaded. One by one, the apostles and preachers of the church are disappearing. And now he is alone on the island of Patmos. And so what was he thinking? God, is this the way it's going to end? I mean, have I used up all the talent that I have? Is there nothing more I can do for you in the kingdom? Is that why you've allowed this to happen to me? And it causes you to ask a very serious question, and that is, where do you go when your life just comes apart? And by the way, I don't care where you are in your life. If you live long enough in this world, one day your life will come apart. I mean, the only way to avoid that is for you to literally pass away. Sometimes people's lives are taken, maybe young or even as you get older. But at some point in time, unless you just suddenly die, you'll have that doctor who will walk in and say to you, I've got some bad news. This last week, I was talking to a friend whose sister-in-law had been diagnosed with cancer. She's the same age as I am. And I thought, what it would be like for the doctor to come in and say, I've got some test results and they're not favorable for you. Or even worse, what if the doctor came in and told June that, or one of my kids? I mean, at some point in time, our lives do fall apart. And the question is, where do you go? What do you do in those moments? You know, you go back to the Bible and you find some stories that are quite amazing. You have the story of Job, for instance. A man who literally lost everything that he owned, then lost his 10 children, all in one accident. I mean, a storm hit the house and they all perished at once. 7 sons, 3 daughters. Can you imagine losing everyone in your family with the exception of you and your wife? And here is Job. And what does Job do? He gets up, he tears his robe, a sign of sorrow. He shaves his head and then he worships. He did what? He worshiped. I mean, the text says, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I'll depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Job, do you not realize what has just happened to you? Yes. But where else do I go? You go to David when David had made the terrible decision to have the affair with Bathsheba and she got pregnant. And you remember how that the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to him and said, look what you've done. You have been forgiven, but the child that she bears is going to die. And David immediately went into prayer, begging God to spare the child's life. And here he is, and he's praying, and he's fasting, and he's literally in sackcloth and ashes, and he sees his servants out there whispering to one another, and he knows that something has happened. Has the child died? Yes, he has. And what does David do? He gets up from the ground, he washes, he puts on lotion, he changes his clothes, and he goes to the temple, and he worships. We were having a gospel meeting that week. It was one of the weeks that changed my life. You've heard me speak of it quite often. I was 17 and my brother, who was 22, had just been killed. It was on Wednesday when that happened, and so they brought his body back and visitation started on Thursday night. And I'm at the funeral home. I'm 17 years old and I'm looking around for Dad. It's about 6:30 and I'm like, where's Dad at? And so I'll go up to Mom and I said, Mom, where's Dad at? I mean, it's visitation for my brother's funeral. And she said, well, he went to attend the gospel meeting. Now, before you think, wow, legalism. You got to be there no matter what. That's not what was going on. Sometime later, when I finally had the ability, I asked Dad about that. I said, Dad, I said, when Rex was killed, you went to the gospel meeting that Thursday night during visitation. Why did you do that? And I've never forgotten what he said. He said, son, I just needed to be close to God. I just needed to be close to God. And so where do you go when your life falls apart? You go to God. I love what Revelation 1:10 says. On the Lord's day. I mean, here's John. And as best I can determine, he's by himself. And Sunday rolls around and it's the Lord's day. And what does he do? He does what he had done all of his life since Jesus had ascended back to heaven. He remembered the Lord. It's the Lord's day. And so here he is, and even though it's just worship of one, it's still worship as he depends on the one who had sustained him for all of his life. And then he enters into the Spirit. You know, I don't know what that means. I mean, it's not like us when we come together and we're filled with the Spirit. I mean, we get encouraged and we're fired up and the Spirit really motivates us. It's more than that. Paul describes a similar incident in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. He says, I will go on to visions and revelations from the Lord. And he talks about knowing a man who 14 years earlier, he too had gone away into a vision. Now he says, I don't know if it was in the body or outside the body. By the way, Paul's talking about himself. And he experienced the same thing that John experienced. He too was carried up into heaven, into paradise itself, before the throne room of God. And notice the last line there. He says, I heard inexpressible things. And the only difference between Paul and John is that Paul couldn't speak of his, and John was told to write his down. John had a purpose, but God had a purpose behind the revelation given to John. And so here's John, and John's been taken up. And as he's thinking about this, and he's entering into this vision, all at once he hears behind him a loud voice like a trumpet. You know, trumpets were used in the first century primarily for military purposes. They didn't have radios. They didn't have walkie-talkies. They had to communicate by blowing trumpets so that the soldiers could hear whether to advance or retreat or attack or whatever it was they needed to do. And here is John, and he's on the Lord's day, and you can almost see him in a meditative spirit. And all at once, I'm sure he jumped as he heard this voice like a trumpet. When I was a teenager, we had a preacher to come by the name of V.E. Howard. I don't know if any of you remember Brother V.E. Howard. He's going to be with the Lord now, but he preached for many, many years, had a radio program. His brother Alton is one that wrote a lot of hymns that are in our songbook, edited two or three of our songbooks. But Brother V.E. had a way of waking you up from your slumber in the middle of a gospel meeting. He'd be preaching along, and all at once he would stop. And of course, when he stopped, you're like, whoa, what just happened? Did I miss the invitation? You know. And then he would say, are you listening? And you're like, whoa, I wasn't. And sometimes he would really, really nail you. He'd say, are you listening in the back there? And Brother Howard had this way. And of course, once you had heard him in the first sermon, you knew it was coming. He wrote a book entitled, Are You Listening? But he did it in every one of his gospel meetings. Two or three times during the sermon, he would stop and say, are you listening? In many ways, that's exactly what happened to John. He hears this voice like a trumpet that says, are you listening? The Bible says that he turned around to see the voice. That's interesting language there, to see the voice. It simply means to see who the voice was coming from. And when he did, he saw seven golden lampstands. I love that image there. He turns and he sees lamps. Lamps were a part of the world back then. I think one of the great things that we take for granted is just the amount of light that we have and the availability of light. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are old enough that you remember before you had electricity in your house? Would you raise your hands? Blake, put yours down. Come on, Blake. I know you don't. Oh, you're from Alabama. Okay, maybe so. I forgot, brother, you're exactly right. My dad used to talk about how that when he graduated high school in 1950 is when they got electricity at their house. I mean, he went all the way through high school studying with a lamp. He said that's why his grades weren't that good. Okay, that sounds good enough. You know, but I mean, to think about living in a world where there's just lamps, that's all you have, and he turns around and he sees these seven lampstands. And he's going to be told in a moment that that stands for the seven churches there of Asia that he's writing to. But more than that, he looks and notices that there's someone that is standing there in the midst of the lampstands. I mean, for someone who is worshiping by himself and wondering, God, where in the world are you at? All at once he remembers the Great Commission, and surely I'll be with you always to the very end of the age. Where is God? He's in the middle of his churches. It's not that he's abandoned them. And then John sees something amazing. He begins by saying, I saw one like a son of man. And I hope you picked that up just a moment ago. He's standing there in the lampstands, but he's like a son of man. And for John, that immediately carried him back. You see, one of the great prophecies in the Old Testament is Daniel 7, 13 and 14. If you don't have this highlighted, you need to highlight it. Because it's one of those prophecies that Jesus read, and basically when he looked at it, he said, that's me. And in it, notice the language here, in my vision, this is Daniel's vision. At night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. Now you need to understand that he's not coming this direction, he's coming that direction. He's not coming from heaven to earth, he's coming from earth to heaven. And notice he approaches the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. And then what happens is truly amazing. He was given authority and glory and sovereign power. And all nations and people of every language worshiped him. Here we are 2,000 years later. And what are we doing? We're fulfilling the very words that Daniel spoke. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. And because of this, Jesus' favorite designation of himself was the Son of Man. over 80 times in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he calls himself the Son of Man. No one else did. Apostles never referred to him that way. The religious authorities never referred to him that way. It was a self-designation of Jesus saying, you go back to Daniel chapter 7 and you'll read about me. Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. The first reference found in Matthew's gospel. Now, why is that important? Because John knew who called himself the Son of Man. It was Jesus. I saw one like the Son of Man, or a Son of Man. There was something about what he saw that reminded him. It made him think of Jesus. Can I ask you a question? If you were asked right now to sit down with an expert artist and to draw a picture of Jesus that you have in your mind, what would he look like? Have you ever thought about it? I mean, if you had to sit down and just simply say, here's what I think Jesus looked like. And I got to be honest with you, I struggle with that because simply I've seen too many Jesuses on the big film. I mean, for instance, how many of you remember Max von Sydow, The Greatest Story Ever Told, 1965? Really the first big attempt to depict Jesus, you know, to audiences all over the world. I still remember 1977. I mean, I was a student at Fried Hardeman, and I was so excited because Jesus of Nazareth was coming out at the theater. And I told June, I said, I want to go see this because they've taken this from the Gospel of Luke. And it's supposed to be kind of this true story of Jesus. And I still remember going to Jackson, Tennessee to see the movie. You say, why Jackson? Because Fried Hardeman's in Henderson. You say, what's the problem with that? There's nothing in Henderson. There was so little in Henderson, Dennis Johnson moved away from there. He's like, I got to get out of here. There's nothing here. I still remember the first time a Sonic came to town. I was between my junior and senior year, the Sonic. They built a Sonic there in Henderson. We were excited. Me and June, another couple, we drove over to the Sonic in my Ford Pinto, and we got there. Back then, they'd bring the food, and they had these little trays that fit on your windows. And so they brought the food, and we ate it, and we were like, boy, this is fantastic, and drove back to the apartment and pulled up, and June said, by the way, you need to go back to Sonic and put the tray back where you found it. It's still on my window. I mean, I'm driving through Henderson with this Sonic tray on my window. I went and saw that movie, though. And I remember walking away going, wow, that was good. In 1993, the Gospel of Matthew came out. And it was an attempt to simply take the book of Matthew word for word straight out of the NIV. They chose Bruce Marciano, struggling actor in Hollywood, but a believer in Jesus. And Marciano tells the story how that when he was leaving Hollywood to fly to South Africa where the film would be made, he was at the airport and he was going through the books in the airport in the religious section looking for something to read while he was flying over. And he found a book called Jesus, Man of Joy. And he grabbed the book, and on the plane, he read it. He had already memorized the book of Matthew, but it changed his entire approach to the life of Jesus, because in that book, the author of the book said, what if Jesus smiled more often than we realize? What if he was someone that just enjoyed life, and it shone through everything that he did? And so the Gospel of Matthew has a smiling Jesus, I mean, all the way through it. And then, of course, how many of you, just out of curiosity, how many of us went and saw this movie, The Passion of the Christ? Maybe half the church. Our church went down to 100 Oaks to watch it. We reserved part of the theater. And I still remember watching Caviezel as he had to learn Aramaic because the entire movie was in Aramaic, the language of Jesus in his day. And I remember when the movie was over, we just sat there in the theater in stone silence. Couldn't say a word. And as we filed out, it was the same way, just total silence at the shock of what at least was depicted by Mel Gibson as happening to Jesus. 2014, Son of God, but Morgado. I mean, there are others that played the role of Jesus. But the problem is, so oftentimes, it's those faces. And can I just tell you that Jesus didn't look like any of those guys? I mean, Isaiah says there was nothing about his appearance that we should desire him. Most of these guys of European descent, they're not Mediterranean. Jesus would have been black-headed. His eyes would have been deep brown, if not black, dark skin, very olive-colored skin. And yet that's the image that I know I have in my head. But it wasn't the image that John saw. And here's what's amazing about that. John knew what Jesus looked like. 40 years had passed since he saw him ascend into the clouds, but he remembered as if it was yesterday what Jesus looked like. But when he turned, that's not what he saw. You almost have to let this sink in. In fact, it's not possible for us to visualize what he saw. John writes it down, but we just don't get it. Look at the words here. Dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet and with a golden sash around his chest. The hair on his head was white, like wool, and as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet was like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters, as if you were in Gatlinburg after it rained and you could just hear the little Pigeon River as it was flowing down. In his right hand he held 7 stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword, and his face was like the sun. You want to catch a glimpse? Leave here this morning as you go out and just look up at the sun and see how long you can look at it. That's what John saw. And I think that when John saw it, his mind immediately went back to the book of Daniel, just like that phrase "Son of Man" came from the book of Daniel. Because in the book of Daniel, you have an angel almost dressed the exact same way. I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like topaz. His face was lightning, very much like the sun. His eyes like flaming torches, just like Jesus. His arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude, very much like rushing waters. Daniel sees it, and Daniel says, "I became pale, and I fell to the ground like a dead man." And the same image is found in Revelation chapter 1. Here's John, and you've got to picture the scene. John knew Jesus, and even though he looked and he sees someone that reminds him of Jesus, when he sees this image, he falls to the ground as though he was dead. And then I love what the text says happened. And he placed his right hand on me. And he said, "Do not be afraid." There are certain things I remember my dad saying. One of them is the way you greet people. I don't know how many times I would hear people come up and say, "LH, how you doing?" And my dad would respond, "I'm tolerable." Tolerable. That's an old country phrase. I asked Dad one time what it meant, and he said, "Well, son, it means you're able to set up and take nourishment, but you're too lazy to work." And I'm like, okay, I can see why you would say that. I'm tolerable. And I use that phrase today. Dad used to call my boys buddy. "Hey, buddy. Hey, partner." I use those terms to my grandsons all these years later. They're familiar words. You see, John had remembered back when they'd caught that great catch of fish at the beginning of their ministry, and Peter was like, "Lord, go away from me, I'm a sinful man." And Jesus' response is, "Do not be afraid." And when they had gone into the house of Jairus, and Peter, James, and John, the only 3 brought in, and here she is, and she's dead. She had only died just a few minutes before they got there. And Jesus' words to all of them, including the apostles, is, "Do not be afraid. She's not dead, she's just sleeping." on the waters of Galilee as they had been rowing across after the feeding of the 5,000. They look up right in the middle of the night and here's somebody walking on water. Nobody walks on water. Only ghosts walk on water. And they scream out in fear and he hears the voice, "Don't be afraid." The same voice that would be heard on the Mount of Transfiguration. He hears again, "Don't be afraid." I can't help but think it was very much like Mary Magdalene after the resurrection. You know, Mary had gone to the tomb. The body is gone. She doesn't know what had happened. Finally, angels had appeared and said, "Listen, he's been raised from the dead." But she's so grief-stricken, she can't believe it. She turns around in the garden and there's a gardener. At least she thinks he's a gardener. "Why are you crying? They've taken my Lord, and I don't know where they've put him. If you'll just tell me where he's at." And then Jesus speaks to her those incredible words, "Mary." And she knows immediately who it is. And I've got to think John did too. I mean, here he is on the ground. He's absolutely scared to death. He's like a dead man. And a hand touches him, a familiar hand. And then a voice that says, "Don't be afraid. I'm the first and the last. Just as God is the Alpha and the Omega. But more than that, I'm the living one. I was dead and now look, I'm alive forever and ever." And with that, John immediately knows who it is. Yes, he looked like Jesus, at least in some ways. And yes, that voice saying, "Don't be afraid," seems so familiar. But now he knows. Because you see, it had been John who had run to the tomb with Peter when Mary had come and said, "They've taken the body." And Peter rushes in and the Bible says he looked around and he literally theorized, "What in the world is going on?" But the text says that John came in and John proudly writes in his gospel, "I was the first one that believed. I looked and I believed." And I can't help but think when Jesus said, "I was dead and now I'm alive," and John, while he's there, goes, "I know exactly who's talking to me." You see, sometimes we just need to remember. I mean, when life is falling apart around us, we need to remember who's been with us all of our lives, who we've put our faith in all of our lives. As Dennis did this morning, I mean, Jesus went and he said, "Listen, here is bread and here's the fruit of the vine." And what's his purpose? His purpose is for us to remember who is he and what he's done. And more importantly, what he's going to do. "And I hold the keys of death and Hades." Oh, I love that. I love that so much. You see, if you go to Israel, Rodney's fixing to take a group. And I'm assuming y'all will go to Caesarea Philippi. Rodney, beautiful place. I was up there 2 years ago. And it's a place where Jesus took the apostles to ask them, "Who do men say the Son of Man is?" And of course, while there, that Peter made the good confession, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And this was a place very different. Here's what it would have probably looked like back then. The Temple of Pan, literally over that opening into the mountainside, that cave that went, at least in the minds of the Romans and the Greeks, into the underworld. And there at that place that looks like this today, you have Jesus saying to Peter, "You're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it." Up until that point in time, the gates of Hades had been secured. You died, you stayed there. But when Jesus came out of the grave, he came out with two things in his possession. He came out with the keys of Hades itself and the keys of death. They were in his hand. And basically what he was saying to John is, "Listen, Rome does not hold your destiny in their hands. I do. You're on the island of Patmos because I've got something for you to do. I've got a vision for you to see. And I've got a message for you to share the world." And we share that message 2,000 years later, just like he did from the island of Patmos to the seven churches of Asia. And you see, he still holds those keys. That's why we go to the funeral home, and we don't go there like the world does. We go there in hope. And we go to the cemetery, but we don't go there like the rest of the world. We go there with hope. It's why when we face tragic news, we know we can face it with hope because we serve and worship the one who holds the key to death itself. And he has conquered it. And he says, so shall you. And that's why we follow him. John looked up and he tried to figure out, who in the world is this I'm looking at? And then he heard his words and knew exactly who he was. And so we extend the invitation in a very simple way today. Do you know who he is? Do you know the one they named Jesus? If not, perhaps it's time to get to know him by being born again of water and the Spirit in his name. Do that right now as together we stand and sing.